Welcome to PowerCast. This month, I'm with Steve Ward. Steve is the founder and executive director of Steps Ministries. That's a nonprofit ministry with the goal to help people improve their lives, grow closer to God, and prevent addiction. Steve graduated from Georgia Tech with a degree in industrial engineering, worked for IBM for 38 years in a number of cities in management and leadership positions for engineering, sales, business transformation, and global marketing. Today, he is a writer, speaker, teacher, consultant, and coach in the areas of personal effectiveness, emotional well-being, spiritual growth, and the prevention of addiction and relapse. He's become a friend to me over the last couple of years, and I'm excited to have him on the show. Steve, welcome.
Jim, thanks so much. It's great to be here at Onan. I love your new building. Love what your company does. The way you go about doing what you do is differentiating and special.
Thank you. I have a little bit of a fear that folks will hear, oh, addiction, this is an addiction guy, and they'll hit the stop button because that's not them. And I just hang on one second. We're going to get to this later, but we're all kind of addicted to something. And this session is really going to be about, we'll get into traditionally what we think about when we talk about addiction, but really it's about overcoming habits and repetitive behaviors that are not serving us, that are not leading to us prospering, not leading us to us thriving personally, professionally. All right. So let's start here, Steve. What is addiction? A lot of people talk about addiction. What's a good definition to kind of set the framework here?
Yeah. First, Jim, that was a great introduction, you know, and you did set it up very well that, you know, we just all have compulsive things that we do over and over again. So the definition of addiction is something that we keep doing, even though it has negative consequences, and we find it extremely hard to stop. In other words, in a way, it's in control of us rather than we being in control of it. It could be an activity that's pleasurable. It could even be one that helps us at work, you know, such as a focus on control, but it becomes compulsive to us. We do it and it's almost in control of us, and it starts to get in the way of our professional and personal responsibilities.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. That's really kind of what addiction is. And as you said, we're all addicted to something, Jim.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a negative stigma about addiction. Talking about substance abuse, what are the characteristics of substance abuse?
Yeah. Well, you are right that there's a negative stigma. And part of why we have this message of we're all addicted to something is everybody needs to see that, hey, they're not different, because we all have these issues, right? And, you know, addiction just... it's not normally a morality or a character issue. Addiction is a medical disease, and it's partly driven by heredity. You know, and the characteristics of it are, you know, it may be something that brings us pleasure or that achieves a purpose for us. In other words, people do what they do for a reason. And when we find a way to either feel less anxious or less depressed or fit in or think sharper, and maybe in some cases we're using a substance to do that, we'll tend to repeat that behavior. And that's how addiction gets started.
Yeah. So you have a impressive resume with IBM, 38 years with IBM. That was kind of the gilded age of IBM too. I mean, it was that they were rocking at the time. So you're a guy who really you were able to climb the corporate ladder and have a lot of success. But you came out and you decided to be public about addiction that you've wrestled with. So how did you get to that place? Number one, I guess, where you felt like you needed to deal with it. And then how did you get to the place where you wanted to get public? I remember the first time I met you, you talked about it. It was kind of shocking. It was a little jarring because you're extremely transparent about it. So how have you gotten to the place today where, I mean, this is what you're doing now, publicly talking about your story and relating to other people about your story. So walk us through that.
Jim, I'm going to take a chance and use a metaphor that just popped into my mind that I don't think I've thought about before, which is between IBM and me. You're right. I joined IBM in the 80s. And at that point, it was a company that was perceived as could do no wrong. It literally dominated the marketplace in ways that were unsurpassed. But somewhere in the late 80s, it figured out that there were some things that it didn't know. And in the early 80s, the company didn't know what it didn't know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
In other words, competitors were catching up, technology was changing, customer needs were evolving. The company didn't know what it didn't know. I was the same way. I started drinking in high school because it achieved a purpose for me, right? It made me feel the way I wanted to feel, which for me was confident, connected, and cool. I wanted to be in the cool crowd, you know, and it solved problems for me. And I carried that into my professional career. I drank for almost 30 years because it addressed things that I wanted to address. I was what you would call a highly functioning alcoholic. I still did very good at work, but there were probably 15 or 20 years where I didn't know what I didn't know. Hmm. And I wasn't realizing the real cost of my habits in many, many, many ways until I finally woke up.
Yeah. What caused you to wake up?
It was a combination of things. Part of the things that kept it secret for a while is I was in marketing and sales for a while. So I was an expert at denial. In other words, I had some really well-tuned sales pitches on why it wasn't a problem for me, right? I only do it after work. I'm not hurting everybody else. I'm still doing it. Good at my job, blah, blah, blah. Those were rationalizations. So that kind of kept it hidden. Another thing, frankly, was my favorite drinking buddy was my wife. It's public knowledge, and it's in our book that she had issues as well. So that kind of helped keep it hidden for a while. And then our older son, as he went from middle school to high school, he developed some serious issues with both drugs and alcohol. So we had kind of a perfect storm there. And it was really the crisis that we were thrust in. There was a spiritual inclination for me to think, you know, is this how I'm going to live the rest of my life? And it was just starting to understand that, you know, I'm just giving away too much of myself, my productivity, just how I'm functioning with life. Even though I was highly functioning, I wasn't at my best.
Mm. So how did you know that? Where's that line? Does that mean you can't drink at all to be at your best? Is that what that means? Or you can't do this, you can't do that? I mean, like, where's that line? How do you know where that line is? How do you know if you're lying to yourself about the line?
There are a couple of very, very popular questions in what you asked. First, I would suggest that there's not, quote, a line. In other words, by the way, there are many, many people who can drink and it's totally fine. Most of my friends drink.
Yeah.
And for someone who can do that and it's not a compulsion, it's well and good. So and addiction is not a number. It's not like if I have 3, it's okay, but 4, it's addicted.
Right.
It's more of a mindset. In other words, are you in control of it or is it in control of you? Mm-hmm. And in fact, an easy sort of test, and this is when people sometimes, including me, start to figure out that, wow, this problem is a little bigger than I thought it was, is when you try to quit. Mm-hmm. You know, I would just make rational things like saying, you know, I'm going to go a month or so and not drink and just see how that goes.
Yeah.
And if you find that really, really hard to do,
that's
probably an indicator.
Probably owns you.
But yet, if you can walk away with it, it's ironic, right? It's if it's okay for you not to do it, it's probably okay to do it.
Yeah.
But if it's hard to let go, then there might be a problem there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's how you got to the point where you decided, I got to deal with this. How did you get to the point where you decided to get so public with it? Because that could be, I mean, it's people hide addiction. I mean, that's just the natural thing to do. We don't want people to know about our weaknesses, our compulsions.
Yeah. That journey took years. You're right, is that the vast number of us will want to keep things like that quiet. We feel ashamed about it. We don't want people to know. And unfortunately, that is a very, very unhealthy behavior. You know, for anybody listening, whether it's you or someone you know, someone in your family or a friend, if they're struggling with any kind of an issue, even if it's anxiety or depression or substances or whatever, you're going to notice they're going to tend to isolate. They're not going to share that part of their life with you or others. Just be a friendly voice and encourage them to talk to somebody about it. So you're right. That's a big part of it. For me, that took years. And it was really, I think, through what was one of the most wonderful experiences I've ever gone through, which was the World of Recovery, which helped me see that. You know, people think recovery is this weird, dark kind of thing that those other people do. Recovery is awesome.
Really?
You know, I go to AA meetings now with 100 people, and a lot of them are CEOs and sales leaders and people. It's a joyful,
really
productive place where people are talking about, how can I be the best person I can be?
Yeah.
And part of that is, you know, you need to become self-aware and understand what your issues are and then share them with someone. And that process is amazing. It's a catharsis to when the first time you tell somebody about an issue you have and you find out that, hey, that doesn't make me a horrible person. Life can still go on. I'm normal. Everybody has issues. That catharsis is incredible. It's it's life changing. Yeah. You know, when you get to that point.
Yeah.
So now I'll tell anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Something that, I have a friend who says, there should be nothing in your life that only you know. Wow, that is really, that is so true. It's that isolation that'll get you.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a tough standard. I like the thought of that.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, all of us, you know, have thoughts and compulsions inside.
Sure.
You know, so, but what I'm saying is when you have a habit that's really creating a negative problem in your life, you're going to tend to want to just hang on to it and not talk to people about it. So the stronger you feel, the more shame you feel about it, the more release you're going to feel when you let that burden down and talk to somebody.
I've heard you say, we are all addicted to something. Are we? Explain that and explain, you know, the types of things people think of: alcohol abuse, drug abuse, those sorts of things. But addiction is a way bigger topic than that. That was really striking to me. I heard you say that. So, what are some examples of types of addictions that people struggle with?
Okay. So when we say that we're all addicted to something, for anyone listening, for you or the people you're close to, just sit back for a couple of minutes and think, can I see myself in that picture somewhere? Right? Most people, when they think of addictions, they think of the classic substance addictions, right? They think of smoking, alcohol and drugs, and they tend to think of the extremes. You know, someone's lying in a gutter, you know, drinking, you know, wine out of a bag or something. Well, first off, as I've said, we've talked about highly functioning addiction, right? So you can be very, very productive at work and still be an alcoholic or a drug addict. So that's one thing. And just know that group of people is a big, big group. It's it is over 40 million people in the United States.
The group of folks
of people who have a substance abuse problem.
40 million. So it's 12% of the population. Yeah,
given moment in a company or in a group, a rule of thumb is that 10% are struggling with issues. So, you know, over the course of their lifetime, about 1 in 7 are going to have a substance abuse problem.
Yeah. So if we have 600 people working here, about 100, 1 in 7?
1 in 7 over the course,
of their life. So 10%, about 60. Yeah. We have about 60 folks that are probably struggling with a classic substance
again,
addiction.
I hope not only some of that 60, but the other 540 are seeing themselves in this. If you're one of the 60, I want you to know that I've been where you are, and I know hundreds and hundreds of people who've been where you are. There are things you can do to feel better, and you will enjoy life better on the other side. For the other 540, keep listening. because you're in the picture too.
You're on the list too.
And, you know, so there are people, especially I talk to a lot of business audiences, and I introduce the concept of being addicted to control. Mm-hmm. And for me, of my many addictions, that's one of them. Mm-hmm. Not only was I addicted to it,
control too,
you know, but it was trained into me. And control is a good thing. But when it becomes compulsive, or when it, you know, creates negative consequences, like you become a micromanager as executive or a leader, you know, so you can be addicted to control. And interestingly, some of the other common addictions out there, when you diagnose them, are tie back to control, things that you may not understand, things like eating disorders or pornography or sexual addiction.
Yeah.
You know, addiction to pornography is rampant.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a guy, right? And a lot of guys just think, well, shoot, I like looking at pretty girls and it's no big deal. Mm-hmm. But even I'm going to make a couple of points in using pornography, which is, it's not something we normally focus on, but I want you to understand that addiction can be a behavior. Mm-hmm. It can be gambling. It can be spending. It can be pornography. Mm-hmm. The other is, even the addiction to a behavior is changing the chemistry of your brain and the structure of your brain. So you need to understand that. And if you're addicted to gambling or to, you know, to some other behavior, it's a very real addiction and you're changing your brain.
The chemical, what's going on chemically with pornography or gambling or a drug, is very similar, right?
If
I understand it.
It absolutely is true chemically. In other words, you're training your body to release dopamine when you do a certain thing.
Yeah.
And your body will follow your lead. You will train it so you will become dependent on it. And your body will therefore stop creating dopamine in these other ways. So you're training yourself to find pleasure in a certain area. Mm. Also, though, it's also the structure of the brain. There's a concept called neuroplasticity, which refers to the neurons in our brain are able to rewire themselves all the time. They're doing it all the time. And if you do a repeated behavior, you're training your brain both chemically and physically to build that behavior in into how you operate.
You know, the cool thing about this is a little tangent here, but that neuroplasticity, that's the term, right? I was reading about that with the fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. A lot of people have in their mind that that's just the way I am and this is how I'm wired and I can't change. And the reality is we can change. It's not easy, but we can change and grow. In fact, we do change and grow in different ways our whole life.
Absolutely.
In our head.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so neuroplasticity can be your worst enemy or your best friend.
What a cool thing.
It is.
Potentially.
A way to take control of your own destiny in a way.
Yeah.
But when we repeat a negative behavior, right, we're encoding that into our brain.
Yeah.
But the opposite is also true. We can rewire our brain. Mm. And it starts by how we think. And then it's what we do. I mean, we are what we repeatedly do. That's a very real statement. And you know.
So what about the micromanaging thing? So is there actually a chemical reaction? Is there a dopamine hit that somebody gets when they are in that micromanaging role, actually?
I'll use that as an example of behavior. Absolutely. In other words,
really?
Anything we use to address an issue that gives us a sense of satisfaction, there probably is. You know, before I left IBM, one of the last guys I worked for was a executive vice president, and he was one of the sharpest guys I ever knew.
Uh-huh.
But I just noticed over time that, man, this guy's control-oriented. You know, he tended to micromanage even his really good people. He was a little bit paranoid about people going over his head.
Yeah.
And I'm quite convinced that it turned out he did have other addictions going on in his life, but he was addicted to the concept of control.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So we're talking about a high achiever there. So, and I've also heard you say that, addiction is actually, pretty prevalent among high achievers. It's kind of a, I don't know, it's correlation, but it's definitely Definitely an interesting pattern there. So talk about that a little bit.
It's actually more prevalent. As you can guess, this is a story that gets a lot of attention in business environments, right? Because when I talk about, if you look at what are the characteristics of many high achieving people, right? It includes a drive for success, perfectionism, self-sufficiency, a high degree of control. If you then look at research on what are the characteristics of addiction, guess what? In many ways, it's the same list.
Yeah.
You know, and then you throw on top of that the fact that many high achievers, whether you know you're a top salesperson or a top performer or you're an executive, and maybe you know you have characteristics such as pride or arrogance. Maybe you have characteristics such as entitlement, like I've worked hard to get here and I deserve that. And you're probably working in a high stress environment. So many issues with people and companies, it's not just, you know, the man or woman in the mail room who's laying around smoking weed, right? Mm-hmm. It might very well be your vice president of operations or one of your top salespeople.
Yeah.
And companies want to hold on to those good people, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why it's a win-win, right? For those people to know, hey, there's something they can do about it and they'll be even better at it. And again, it helps them personally and it helps the company professionally.
How prevalent is substance abuse in work environment? I guess we talked about that some, but expand on that a little bit more.
Well, let's first work backwards. And we know that about 75% of those people who have a substance abuse problem are working full time. Okay.
Wow.
They're not laying around.
Right. They're not homeless.
Mostly, right. Yeah, they're working full time. So guess what that means? They're working for somebody, mm-hmm. you know? So we know that they're out there in the workforce. The other is that by industry, you know, the 10% number I said before is sort of a rule of thumb. It varies by industry. If you look at the legal industry or the medical industry, or if you isolated, you know, business executives from the overall business population, you would see those numbers are higher than 10%.
Wow.
You know,
why is that? Just the stress and the wiring of folks that are drawn to that type of job, huh?
Yeah, I think partly is what we talked about is the wiring that leads you to get to the top of the heap and fight your way forward and control things and not pay so much attention to the other you know, some of those characteristics that in some business environments can lead to success are not healthy. And they're going to lead to issues which people solve with problems. And then again, if you're a little bit on the overconfident side and you rationalize that, hey, I work hard, play hard. You know, what's the big deal? I closed a deal today. So why can't I go home and slam some beers or drinks? You know, that sense of entitlement or desire, all those things work together.
Yeah.
And then what compounds it is that people in high functioning environments, it's sometimes harder for them to let go and reach out and get help. Again, maybe it's pride. Maybe they're scared that people will know that it will affect their career and all those things. All those things can be worked through. But, you know, that isolation and not letting go is what will hurt you in the long run.
How do most companies deal with addiction?
It varies a great deal. Even though I would not say this is statistically researched, I'm pretty confident in it, that most of them don't do it very effectively. Mm-hmm. A significant number of companies ignore the problem.
Yeah.
By the way, it's not out of ignorance, because if you ask human resource leaders around the country, they know that substance abuse is a major problem. Mm-hmm. They know that. It's, you know, 80% of them would rank it as one of the top problems affecting the workforce. But it's an uncomfortable issue, you know, and it's kind of hard to deal with. And, you know, and it's something that a lot of people would say, well, I just don't want to think about that today. So we keep sweeping it under the rug and not dealing with it. So,
yeah. How should companies deal with it then? Cause it's like, oh my goodness, do I really want to look under that rock type of issue?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do to make a difference. And frankly, this podcast is one of them, right? With this podcast, Onan is not necessarily, you know, looking under the rock. This is a very easy way to get information or education out there to the people. And those who have ears will hear, and those who are in denial won't.
Right.
So I guarantee you that if there's, you know, 100 or 1,000 people listening to this, some people are going, I'll be darned. I'd never really heard this before. And, you know, maybe that's something I should think about. So just getting information out there for awareness and education is a big plus. Mm-hmm. And you can just do that in a push way. It's easy, it's efficient, it's cost effective, and that's a big part.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. What would you say to somebody who has ears and they're embarrassed or afraid to deal with it, or just kind of, they've been putting it off. They kind of know in their gut. What do you have to say to them?
If you only hear one thing, and I said this earlier, but I want some people to listen to this to hear this. You're not broken and you're not alone. You're absolutely normal, that we all have issues that we're dealing with, and most of them hide them very well. But there are things you can do to get better. And if you'll take some positive steps, your life will get better. You'll be more content, more productive, happier, and all that. You know, so I would like, you know, anyone to hear that.
You know, you said you'll be happier, be more productive. If drinking's enjoyable, or doing, you know, getting high is enjoyable, smoking cigarettes is, you know, eating a whole pizza is enjoyable, you know? So really life's more enjoyable on the other side of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a very honest question. And one of the things I worry about sometimes when I'm talking to a group is, you know, cause I'm not trying to be a buzzkill for all you people out there. you know what I mean? And I'm not trying to say if you have two or three drinks and that relaxes you, that's a bad thing and you got to stop. What I'm trying to address are those people whose issues are starting to fragment their life and it's causing pain. Mm. You know, people do what they do for a reason. And, you know, drinking felt pretty good to me.
Yeah.
Right. So I did it for a long time, and people take pills because it makes them feel better. Mm-hmm. So in the short run, it is a true statement that substances can give you a pleasurable feeling. Mm-hmm. But as I said, you're now training yourself to say, my coping with life depends on me taking that substance.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I'm going to figure out how to deal with life on its own terms. You know, I'm going to face stress, but I'm going to figure out a healthier way to do that that doesn't depend on a substance. The other thing is that addiction is a progressive disease. It will almost certainly get worse over time. Mm-hmm. It could be slow. It could be fast. Yeah. So it will get worse. And the other thing I would suggest is when you begin to really count the cost of what we're doing, you might be surprised at what the cost is. You know, I said I was highly functioning, you know, because I thought I was a pretty good dad, pretty good husband, and doing great at work. And I was. But when you start thinking, you know, am I really there for my family the way I should be? Am I there for all my friends? You go all through the elements of counting the cost and you find, wow, this is changing who I am. So it's really that big picture that says, over the course of my life, I want to be a certain kind of person. That's what hit me. I just thought, man, when I'm 65 or 70 or 80 and I look back, I don't want to be saying to myself, you know, I gave up a good bit of what life was all about just to have a good buzz.
Yeah.
You know, that thought scared me to death. Mm. And so it is right.
Yeah.
You know, that you do give up some pleasure in the short term, but the contentment and the satisfaction and the purpose and the relationships and the self-satisfaction and the productivity that you get in the long run outweigh it.
Yeah. Playing the long game. We have a saying we've adopted around here, the obstacle is the way. And when we face an obstacle, we face pain, resistance in life, I believe that life happens for us, not to us. But if we pull the parachute and turn to a substance or negative behavior or whatever it is, we're bypassing that opportunity to get better, get stronger, to learn, you know?
Absolutely. I talk to a lot of people sometimes about stress and anxiety, right? And they'll say things like, well, I wish I didn't have stress. Well, yeah, that will never happen.
Right.
In other words, life will have stress and it will have anxiety, but you can change your mindset about it, right? Yeah. And you can see that stressful situations are an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, if you kind of step into the problem,
yeah,
and if you find that, you know, that event when my boss was, you know, kind of said something to me that hurt my feelings, that used to just stress me out for days.
Yeah.
Wonder if I step back and I have a broader perspective on it, I treat it like, this could be some constructive advice that could help me feel better. And I'm going to take a walk for a little while till I relax. And then I'm going to do something I like listening. In other words, you figure out a constructive way to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just think of that.
Yeah.
Rather than that being a problem that bothers you for the rest of your life, you've now built an effective lifestyle to deal with it.
Yeah. You mentioned high functioning addiction. What does that mean?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's when I first started the nonprofit ministry steps, I didn't used to describe myself with that term, high functioning addiction, because I kind of thought I was tricking people, right? Like I was acting like I wasn't really one. But I found that it really opens up a lot of people's eyes when I talk about that concept. Mm. There are many, many, many people out there who are successful at their business career. They may be good at family. They may be good at their hobbies, but they still may have a compulsive habit, which has negative consequences. And they find, so you can be a high functioning alcoholic or addict. You know, the fact that you are doesn't mean you're not one.
Right, right. Okay, let's move on to prevention and recovery here. So you talk about the idea of preventing addiction. Where did that come from? What does that mean?
This thought process, which really happened over, I don't know, a year and a half in my life, is what changed the trajectory of my life. I mentioned that our family had issues with myself and my wife and our son. So I was involved in recovery in all of its forms, right? I was going to some meetings, and my wife was, and my son was in residential recovery twice. And so we talked to counselors and family groups. And what I discovered in the world of recovery is, you know, I actually enjoyed it. Mm. I found it enlightening because it's, you know, knowledgeable people helping me understand myself and life better.
Yeah.
So that I can live life better. So I thought that's pretty cool. And then I also saw the facts about recovery. And I saw that, well, I'll be darned, it actually works.
Mm.
There are tens of millions of people, tens of millions in the United States who have successfully gone through recovery. Problem is, most of them don't talk about it. So,
you know,
all of us know people who've had a successful recovery and they're living a better life now, but they tend to kind of keep that, you know, secret. They don't talk about it. So it was really all of those things, you know, that led me to realize that addiction is treatable. And then when I saw that what they teach you in recovery is a lifestyle that helps you be more effective personally, emotionally, spiritually, professionally, I just thought, why don't we do that earlier? Why do we wait until people crash and burn and their lives come apart and then they go through 2 years of recovery? That makes no sense.
Yeah, work further up the further up the stream.
Just start doing positive things earlier and enjoy the benefits.
Mm. Okay, like what?
It doesn't have to be complicated. When I talk a lot about what's involved, I divide it up into five areas. You know, one is just having an effective lifestyle, right? In other words, do you have balance in your life? You know, are there things that that you do that keep you happy, or the things that make you feel productive? You know, emotionally, spiritually, personally, professionally, do you have balance? Are you intentional about how you live your life?
Mm-hmm.
Does the concept of wellness and being healthy in many ways, are you intentional about building that into your life? A second area is awareness. Are you aware of the stressors around you and mm-hmm. what they're doing to you? Are you self-aware?
Yeah.
Do you notice what it is that pushes your buttons? And do you become aware of the problem so that no longer do you not know what you don't know? A third area is connection. Talk to someone. Get connected to resources. Even if it needs to be anonymous, start reading things, but try to find one person you can trust to talk to. And a fourth is education. You know, there are ways to live life better. You know, there are you can learn how to cope with issues and make better choices and why that helps you be more productive and more content at the same time. So just kind of learn those techniques for dealing with life better. And the fifth area is kind of interesting. We were built to do things that have purpose and meaning to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're wired that way.
Yeah.
And if all of your free time is being taken up by your addictive habit or by things that have no meaning, you'll eventually kind of feel the effects of that. But once you engage in something that does give you a sense of purpose and meaning, then you'll tend to find, wow, this is a lot more exciting than me sitting around slamming beers all day long.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's it like for somebody? What is the addiction cycle? What's it like as somebody moves through that addiction cycle?
There are some very clear stages that people tend to go through.
Yeah.
And when we're going through it, you know, we may not have a tendency to notice it. In other words, we don't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
You know, we're kind of mired down in the details. So I would ask, you know, everybody now to sort of step back from your life and think about it, but also for the people you know. You know, it starts with, I just use the expression, life happens. You know, life's not all good. You know, sometimes things happen to us, they cause us stress, they make us sad, or maybe we just aren't getting the raise that we wanted, or we're not as happy. So life happens and we feel like we've got to do something about it to fix it. So that's perfectly normal there, but kind of that's where it starts.
Mm-hmm.
The second is our thinking tends to evolve. Addiction is a brain disease. It's a thinking disease. And we tend to start to slowly or rapidly obsess on ourselves. In other words, I'm not getting what I want. I'm the victim. I'm not happy enough. I'm not calm enough. I deserve more. The more obsessed we are with self, the more likely we are to say, hey, I deserve to solve my problems by doing whatever it is. So our thinking starts to change with a compulsion on self. Then, as I've said, we start to isolate. Now, isolate could be kind of a deceptive at first, right? You may still be around a lot of people. You may go to work, you may have friends, but if you notice there's a part of your life that you're not sharing with anyone,
mm-hmm.
it's the part you keep hidden from, certainly from everybody at church, certainly from everybody at work, probably from your friends, maybe from your spouse. If there's a part of your life that you're keeping hidden, then in effect, you're isolating.
Yeah.
But what you'll notice over time too is like with me, right? I stopped hanging around with my buddies who didn't like to drink because, you know, they just bring me down. And I was in sales at the time, right? So, you know, we would work hard, play hard. You know, we go out after work and that was a thing to do, you know? So notice a tendency to isolate and be wary of that.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, you know, when we're not self-aware, we're tending to isolate and we're not educated on what to do. So we don't notice that these triggers lead to these actions. In other words, when that happens, I do this. But we can be educated on that. And we can just learn, okay, when I start to feel this need or that stress or whatever, I can interrupt that behavior and I can cope with that in a healthy way. You know, so when we stop paying any attention to how are we living, then these repetitive behaviors become habits. And mm-hmm. we've talked a lot about these. And then the habits become compulsive. And all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, sometimes this process could take several years. We realize that our substance or behavior of choice is in control of us.
Mm-hmm.
We can't stop. Our life is starting to come apart and we crash and it blows up.
For people out there who, maybe they relate to, I do have some addictive behaviors, but maybe it's not owning them yet, but they have people in their lives. Maybe it's somebody they work with. Maybe it's a family member. Maybe it's a friend that they see. They're really kind of moving. They're progressing pretty rapidly through this cycle that you just went through. What do you do?
I mentioned a couple of things. One, to kind of hopefully give you a sense of release first, that if it's someone close to you, even if it's your spouse or your kid, you need to understand that you can't fix or control them. It's not your responsibility and you're not able to. You might like to, but you can't. But that said, there are things you can do to help. You don't have to know anything about addiction or recovery, right? Just be a good friend and a good person. In other words, be aware of them. If you have a friend that you've been, or a coworker that you've been hanging around for years, and all of a sudden they're just now kind of repeatedly canceling times to get together, and you notice they're not sharing much with you anymore, you know something's going on. So be aware. The others, be available. You know, be around them. You know, create situations to be around them. Third is be empathetic. You know, understand that they may be struggling with something that's bothering their world. And again, your job is not to fix or control them. It's just to be there for them and connect for them and to understand, to listen to their world and let them know that there's somebody that they can talk to. And from there, you know, then you become a positive force for change in their lives, right? Again, you can't control them, you can't fix them, but you can help walk with them toward taking some positive steps. So it starts with that. Frankly, it's being a good friend or a good spouse or a good dad or a good coworker and saying, you know, I'm willing to get a little bit into their space and be there for them, but I'm not going to judge them and I'm not going to fix them. I'm just going to listen.
What if you're a manager or somebody that, like, man, there's something going on there, you know, or maybe even performance is suffering. There's some manifestation earlier stages. They're not totally off the rails, but you're seeing, or maybe you're seeing behavior that's not at work, but you know, golly, man, that's, you know, there's an issue there that is going to eventually manifest here at work. What do you do as a manager?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there are an additional set of responsibilities that a business manager has, right? So it is perfectly fair for a company and a manager to expect that their employees are going to produce the value for which they're getting paid. So if they're not performing, it certainly is a valid thought process to say, I need to start having conversations with them about, you know, are we meeting their performance goals and why or why not?
Yeah.
But even that process, right? You can go about it in a control-oriented, negative, attacking, why aren't you doing your job, fix it or you're out of here. Or you can say...
the addictive control track.
Good catch on that. You know, or you can say, let's talk about this. It seems like maybe we haven't been meeting some of our goals. Why do you think that is? And, you know, what can we do to help you get better? You know, so you can even go through that performance evaluation process in a different way.
Yeah.
But the other thing I would suggest is, you know, people are more than just a human resource, right? They are people. Mm-hmm. And if you let them know that, hey, you're a person too, that, you know, in fact, just to introduce the concept that, hey, it's okay not to be okay sometimes.
Yeah.
If you have stress or you feel sad and it finds you, you know, that's not a game breaker. You know, that's just, you're normal. So to kind of give people permission to not be perfect.
Yep.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, I think that is. You know? Yeah. I mean, we're trying to play the long game here. You work with somebody for 5 years, they're going to go through some negative cycles. Yeah. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I'm going to, everybody's going to, you know? Okay. So, well, let's bring it home. Your ministry, your goal here revolves around life improvement, the concept of life improvement. So are there any suggested steps? And maybe, you know, you talked in, you know, those five categories, but maybe get a little more concrete about what those resources might be, maybe where they go to them, those steps. Do you, we'll certainly put, access to your website, in the show notes, and ways to get connected to you, but are there some specific steps that you'd like to leave folks with?
Yeah. And as you said, if you only remember one resource, go to lifeimprovementsteps.com. And there are videos and podcasts and articles that you can read through. Obviously it's at your own Discretion is totally confidential. It's just online information. So go to lifeimprovementsteps.com. There's information there for parents. There's information there for people who, I'm starting to wonder if maybe my substance problem is becoming an issue. I just want to learn more. What is this concept of high functioning addiction? You can learn that if you want to improve your life and just be more productive. So go to lifeimprovementsteps.com.
You mentioned kids. And that's a big part of what you do, working with parents who are trying to help their kids out with addiction or to avoid addiction. That's, I've heard somebody say, you're only as happy as your saddest child, as parents. I mean, my goodness, what a great resource. What a huge topic that is.
Yeah. When we were building the strategy for our nonprofit, if you're trying to say, how do I reach people and get further upstream to help people learn to live life better and avoid issues from taking them down, parenting became a natural, right?
Sure.
Because, parents by definition are around their kids as they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
So, at that website, lifeimprovementsteps.com, up in the top left, there's an area called proactive parenting. Mm-hmm. We have online resources for parents that can help them, especially if your kids are in the teenage years and they're at risk or they're starting to do things that you're worried about, go there. But parents have a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah.
But unfortunately these days, parents are busy. Mm-hmm. They're just busy with life and with kids. And we also have this orientation, whether we know it or not, to kind of focus on one or two metrics and think they determine whether our kid's doing okay.
Right.
Generally, we look at, are their grades okay? And are they doing well at their activity of choice?
Mm-hmm.
Which could be dance or piano or sports. Well, we need, their health and well-being is deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
It involves things like, are they developing the tools to live life well? Or are they developing self-awareness? What is their sense of self? How do they deal with issues? When one of their friends says something which upsets them, are they learning the ways to deal with that? It involves, do they have a spiritual connection to a power higher than them so they know they don't have to depend on life on their own? Personally, are they developing competence in areas that give them a sense of self-confidence? So parents have a wonderful opportunity, and parents don't have to be perfect. I know you're busy, but there are some simple things that you can do. And it will help your kids grow up to be more content, more happy, more fulfilled. And by the way, as they get into the teenage years, it will give them self-defenses against the temptations that they absolutely will face.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, one more question for you. What have I forgot to ask you about? Is there anything, any final thoughts that you want to leave the folks with? Or have we covered... Do you think we need to put just a period at the end right there?
I'll emphasize, this might be the third time I've said this, because I want people to hear this. You and the people some of you are struggling with issues, whether it's anxiety or depression or some form of substance abuse. It's all around you, whether you know it. But that doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means you're absolutely normal. You're okay. Become aware of that. You're not broken. You're not alone. There are steps you can take to get better, I promise. And it may not be easy for a while, but there are things you can do. I hope you find some help on lifeimprovementsteps.com. And what I can also promise is that a life that's focused on living it the way it's designed to be will give you just a sense of self-satisfaction that I promise a pill or a drink won't do.
Now, yeah.
Again, if part of that, you're able to manage, a healthy, relationship with alcohol, that's fine. It's well and good. But no matter what, we all have issues. We're all addicted to something, and there are positive steps we can take to get better.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Steve.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So we'll put a period there, and I hope you enjoyed it, and we will talk to you next month, or you'll hear me talking to you, I guess, next month on PowerCast.